and gentlemen, welcome back. Good to be back with you once again. My name is Henrik, this is Red Eyes TV, and today we are going to talk more in-depth with Kyle Bristow. If you checked our New Year stream, at the end of the year stream, rather, Kyle was one of the people that joined in for kind of a brief moment, and of course we realized at that point that there's much more to discuss, you know, to the cases and to the kind of activism and law that Kyle has been involved in. So I thought we should bring Kyle on and do more of an in-depth interview. So welcome, Kyle. Good to have you back.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm honored to be here. I love your show.
Oh, thank you, Cal. I appreciate that. So let's just kind of take it from the top, if you don't mind. How the heck did you get involved with the kind of cases that you've been fighting here in the recent months?
Well, back when I was, it all started out in high school, I developed a hatred for liberalism when I was probably about a junior in public high school. And when I was a senior in high school, I started a Young Republicans Club. And it was fiercely nationalistic, and it was probably not Republican by today's standards. You know, we were out doing a petition gathering to oppose affirmative action, which the GOP, you know, has pretty much always supported. But anyways, though, when I got to Michigan State University for undergraduate school, about 2005 it was, I joined a group called the Young Americans for Freedom. And in 2006, I ended up being appointed to serve as the president of the organization. And as president of the group, I hosted a number of right-wing nationalistic speakers, people who would be considered largely alt-right or alt-right by today's standards. I, in fact, hosted Mark Krikorian of the Center for Immigration Studies to talk about immigration problems. I hosted Tom Tancredo, then a congressman, to talk about immigration. We hosted Nick Griffin of the British National Party to talk about radical Islam and immigration problems. We hosted Chris Dimcox of the Minuteman Civil Defense Corps, not once but twice, to talk about our immigration-related problems. And you know, so I was always very active in, you know, these types of, you know, political causes. In fact, when Michigan banned affirmative action by ballot initiative in 2006, Jennifer Gratz, who was the plaintiff in the Gratz v. Bollinger U.S. Supreme Court case concerning affirmative action, she thanked my group by name for our instrumental effort in, you know, getting affirmative action outlawed in Michigan that year. Because of my experiences with right-wing politics, I have always butted heads with radical leftists and governmental actors who discriminated against me then, just as they are discriminating against our activists the current year. And I have an appreciation and an understanding how public universities work, especially with the various leftist elements within them. And, you know, I ended up going on to law school. I have a law degree from the University of Toledo, and I am licensed to practice law in both Ohio and Michigan. I did both bar exams and admitted to a number of different federal courts. And I am using my personal experiences with having dealt with universities yesteryear and the legal training I have today to really stand up for the constitutional rights of our activists. And I have no qualms whatsoever with filing suit against left-wing university administrators in federal court for trampling upon the First Amendment rights of our activists. And so far, I have succeeded, you know, in a number of cases in the context of standing up for the First Amendment for alt-right activists. I ghostwrote documents and did legal research for attorney Sam Dixon when he sued Auburn University on behalf of Cameron Padgett when Padgett wanted to host Richard Spencer as a speaker. We won a preliminary injunction there. And the school ended up settling for just a hair less than $30,000. When Jason Kessler wanted to have a rally at Lee Park in Charlottesville on August 12th, of last year, the Charlottesville government told him, no, you can't do that. And Kessler called up various advocacy groups to see if they would help him, and they originally all turned him down. But when he told the American Civil Liberties Union that he knew this attorney up in Michigan who would do a lot of the grunt work for them, and they could take all the credit, they jumped at that. I did the legal research for the ACLU. I drafted documents for them. They filed paperwork, and they ended up getting an emergency preliminary injunction so that the event in theory would happen at Lee Park. We, of course, know what happened with that. The city of Charlottesville did not maintain law and order. They arguably violated that preliminary injunction, but nevertheless, we prevailed in court there. And then I have sued a number of public universities in the last few months for not letting my client, Cameron Padgett, rent publicly available rooms at which Richard Spencer, Padgett, and other invited guests would speak about their political ideas. And I recently sued Michigan State University, and the university threw everything they possibly had at me. However, we ultimately prevailed, and the university settled out of court. They paid $27,400 to me as attorney's fees. They have agreed that Richard Spencer will speak at Michigan State University on March 5th of this year, and that my client will not need to pay any money whatsoever for the cost of security, which is just an incredible First Amendment victory.
Yeah.
And, it's fascinating with that case. Michigan State, they did not use their in-house attorneys to try to fight me off. They ended up hiring a very competent, well-known attorney in Michigan who's very knowledgeable of federal litigation. And then they hired a massive international law firm. They have offices all throughout the world, and they had a number of attorneys fly in to Michigan from their Washington, D.C. office to try to deal with the case. And, I mean, they, in fact, it was Obama's attorney general, I'm forgetting her name. Forget the name, it doesn't matter.
Sure.
But these were very well-connected lawyers, very intelligent, seasoned attorneys. I mean, the one had gone before the United States Supreme Court dozens of times for cases. I mean, they brought out the A-team, and nevertheless, the law was on our side, the facts were on our side, I held their feet to the fire, and we were able to prevail in this manner.
That's a great great victory, obviously, and a really good, important step in that moving in this direction, because there's been so much, there's nothing else to call it, discrimination on political ideologies against people who hold the wrong beliefs, so to speak. What can you say about that specific case and how that turned out, though? I mean, was it a difficult process for you, or was it fairly easy? How did it feel like a case?
I knew the law, and I knew the facts, and I know court procedure, so it was relatively easy for me to bring forth our claims. I did get admonished by the federal judge in front of the media when the case was called. She said that it was unprofessional of me to refer to Antifa as an international unincorporated collective of communists. And I thought I actually put it nicely. In the draft of my complaint, I had referred to them originally as man animals. So, I mean, communists, I guess, okay, but... it was a very successful outcome, very pleased with it, and it really does set the stage for other universities which are wrestling with the issue of whether their students get to exercise a heckler's veto over speech that they don't like.
Right.
I mean, with leftists, they're not even liberal. They're not classically liberal at all. They are communists. They are Marxists. They are totalitarian thugs. If they had their way, we would just be in one giant safe space with trigger warnings and what we think would be hate speech, and I would be a crime think criminal. It's really Orwellian.
You'd be in the gulags, Kyle.
Yeah.
So how does this work legally? Maybe you can explain that to us. Can this case now, MSU be used as a precedent? No.
It can't be used as a precedent because the university settled out of court. The judge did not issue an opinion or an order.
Okay.
However, legal scholars who followed this case, virtually every single legal scholar, I think all of them, in fact, have said that, you know, I'm going to prevail one way or the other for this case. And, I mean, the liberals have even said that I'm the lawyer version of the New England Patriots. Everybody hates my guts, but they all know that I'm going to win at the end of the day.
Well, that's good. That's a good reputation to have, specifically in these circles. Now, before we talk more about this, tell us about those. So you were obviously involved in you know, conservative Republican, you know, groups primarily in your early years. How did you come into the alt-right, and how did that kind of transition happen?
I was, and this is something that's very embarrassing that I don't tell anybody. I was actually the president of the International Club at my high school.
Nice.
Which would, for all intents and purposes, be the diversity club. and I was that at the same time I was the president of the Young Republicans Club that I had founded. And, I mean, back then I was a staunch neoconservative, you know, fiercely patriotic, pro-America. And I think that I conflated statism with patriotism. A real patriot is someone who loves his people and who advances their rights. A statist is somebody who just advances the government's interests. And I think that, you know, that was, you know, just due to a lack of understanding and immaturity back in the day. But when I got to Michigan State University, I read a number of books. I was a prolific reader of everything I could get my hands on. I stopped reading what the professors assigned to me. I went out and purchased my own books and read them. And so I'm pretty much self-taught. But talking with people at Michigan State, mid-2000s, we were, by and large, paleoconservative or nationalistic. You know, some people would consider themselves paleo-libertarian. These are all terms that are pretty much no longer used today. You know, people either are alt-right or alt-left or alt-light or whatever we call it. But eventually a person, I, you know, by personally witnessing how liberals responded to my patriotic conservative or then conservative speech, I grew a real hatred for these creatures. I mean, just real disgust. And, you know, I basically come to understood that liberals truly hate white people. That is the basis of liberalism. And that's what James Burnham argued in his The Suicide of the West. He said, if you look at how liberals think, how they act, the public policy positions they take, a lot of it is illogical, but there is one driving factor behind it all. It is a hatred of white people, a hatred of Western civilization and our heritage. And, you know, so through my personal experiences, I would say that the liberals made me into the person that I am today.
Yeah.
And a driving factor behind it, too, was somebody gave me a copy of a book edited by Sam Francis. I think it was called Race and the American Question or Race and the American something like that. It was basically a collection of essays written by various nationalists about all kinds of different issues. You know, one essay was in there. It was written by Sam Dixon, a friend of mine, an attorney, who talked about how people who are, slave owners, advocates of slavery back in the Confederate days, they were basically the modern day corporatists of today. They were importing cheap labor from the third world to the detriment of our people. And, you know, I never thought of the slavery issue like that before. They had scholarly essays about biological differences, about the differences in intelligence and physical traits. You know, the R versus K factor when it comes to reproduction. There were so many different essays in here, and it just blew my mind. And then what really did me in was I hosted Nick Griffin as a speaker at Michigan State. And when he spoke, he articulated a fiercely pro-European position, a political position. Conservatives pride themselves on being colorblind. You know, they're opposed to affirmative action because they want a colorblind society. Nick Griffin would argue he's opposed to affirmative action because affirmative action is detrimental to the rights of white people. And to hear a political philosophy espoused in such a clear manner, I think that that was very enlightening.
When was that, by the way? When was the Michigan State?
Nick Griffin, I think, spoke in 2007 or so.
Okay.
And, I mean, I was an alt-right shitlord before there was an alt-right and before the word shitlord was even around. So
how does this shape your career consequently? Is there enough people that come to you now in terms of with cases and things like this, or is this something you have to do on the side still?
Okay. I am busier than heck because I have a fierce reputation for just not putting up with anybody's crap, and prospective clients and real clients, actual clients, very much appreciate that. Most days is family law, divorce, child custody disputes, modified parenting time arrangements, stuff along those lines. I do criminal defense a little bit, not too much. I do a lot of civil litigation, commercial disputes, contractual disputes, allegations of fraud, stuff along those lines. And then, now I'm dabbling in advocacy to defend the rights of alt-right activists. There is definitely high demand for alt-right activists as far as legal services is concerned.
Yeah, that's correct.
Alt-right people lose their jobs, and so they are faced with the issue of employment discrimination and who defamed them or tortiously interfered with their employment. They need assistance with negotiating severance agreements to maximize the payout so they don't sue their former employers when they do lose their jobs. I have had people need assistance with criminal defense representation. There was even a time during when Trump appeared in Detroit, an alt-right activist waving around a Confederate flag downtown Detroit. Not advisable to do that. I would encourage that. A police officer came up and put him in handcuffs, and activists on the scene had me on speed dial. I was talking to him before, or with our people there, before he was even in the back of the squad car. You know, so just being able to have that rapid response is critical, for purposes of being able to help people. I have assisted, other than the First Amendment cases, I have also assisted college students who have been accused of violating anti-discrimination policies by hanging up alt-right posters on their campuses. And so far, we have a 100% success rate when a school begins a disciplinary proceeding. They notify the police that they're not happy about a poster being hung up. Usually, so far all the time, I have been able to get the universities to drop the disciplinary proceedings and for the police to back off too. And so having this legal support structure in place is huge.
Yeah, definitely something which is vitally important, especially now. I'd say, we all know it, but especially after Charlottesville, this has stepped up to a new level where they're going after people because of the political beliefs. And I've always said we have to fight back legally against this. There has to be things we can do legally to prevent further people from being basically put in a position where they can no longer support their own family because of their political beliefs.
Right. Charlottesville is being used as pretext by the left to discriminate against the alt-right.
Yeah.
The left wanted to discriminate against the alt-right from the get-go. But now, because of the Charlottesville fiasco, they are able to point to Heather Heyer's death or the helicopter being blown up out of the sky, whatever they're alleging. I haven't even paid attention to it. It's really all leftist on right-wing violence. That's really what's going on. If you look at all of these different events, even Charlottesville, I mean, you had black nationalists and communists running around with improvised flamethrowers made out of aerosol cans. You had them throwing acid on people like Baked Alaska, you know, targeting them in the eyes, trying to cause permanent blindness. You know, people I know who went to Charlottesville relate to me that there is a very violent faction of Antifa that carries weapons, and that they may have even received military training fighting ISIS in northern Iraq, where they team up with the Kurds and their communist movement. And
I can confirm that that is true. There was actually, I forget the source now, but there was an article series about that about that issue.
Right.
And it sounds kind of, you know, outlandish first, but the PKK has obviously had a very strong force there, which is the Kurdish Communist Party, if you will. And there is actually an interface between these groups there, so that's true.
Right. They're going abroad to get military training, and they're coming back here. You know, ideologically, they are political terrorists, and technically, they are acquiring the training they need to make roadside bombs and to do assassinations. And we are in very challenging times, if you will, because of what's going on. And contemporary conservatism has not adequately addressed these problems. It's really only the alt-right which does so.
Yeah, that's true. They look the other way. They don't think of these groups as being very, maybe ideologically driven the way that they are.
It's actually funny you mentioned that. I'm actually at an undisclosed location right now, my law office. I'm one of the few attorneys who doesn't publicize where their office is located. I use a P.O. box, but otherwise I'm at a hidden location, and I'm armed at all times because I don't want a pinko commie coming in here and trying to take me out.
Yeah, well, that's understandable. You gotta protect yourself these days. With everything that's happened, that's a very sensible position to take, frankly. Cal, I wanted to ask you as well about go back to 2008 and talk about the Bolshevism activism, if you will, at MSU as well. You were involved in that back then. You were on Hannity, were running one of these clips that detailed or that focused on the story back then. Tell us about that a little bit for those who don't remember that.
Right. Back in 2006, 2007, I was affiliated with the Michigan State University Young Americans for Freedom while I was a student at that campus. And I hosted a number of right-wing speakers, and we always arranged for the events to be open to the public, and the leftists would show up to try to shut them down. At one event, when Congressman Tom Tangredo spoke, the leftists actually physically assaulted a pregnant woman, and I actually jumped into the crowd to rescue her. I think she was like 6 or 7 months pregnant at the time. I mean, these leftists are just vile, violent people. And, we needed very serious police protection to protect us from them. And mostly it's because the left-wing university professors rile up their students so much. I mean, they are horrifically indoctrinated. They are taught to hate people who are patriotic and who are right of center, politically speaking. People who are Christian, and so we basically took a stand, and through our speaking events, we were able to, relay our message to the public.
Very, very important case.
Yeah. Keep the clip going. Watch this. Sure. He's about to get arrested. This is great. Watch this. watch what happens.
Did you shoot this footage?
We took him down.
did you shoot this footage?
No, they would have killed me if I was in a crowd like that. I was behind like a whole army of police. In fact, the police gave me an escort off campus. After the event, they put me in a squad car and took me to an undisclosed location.
Jeez.
So,
how did this happen? How did this happen in America? I mean, think about it. How did this movement become so large and so, I don't know if it's powerful, but it's influential. And there's a lot of, as you said, professors, there's a lot of people in key positions that keep, you know, churning out more Bolsheviks and new communists because they get to the young at an early age.
Well, I think that people no longer think for themselves these days. They don't read books on their own. They basically go through school and they are taught to believe what they're supposed to believe. I mean, people are start out so young these days. I mean, even in kindergarten, from Martin Luther King Jr. Propaganda. I mean, if you listen to the leftist teachers and, you know, who are taught by leftist professors, I mean, it's very ugly. And I think that, through the alt-right and through our own vehicles we use to transmit our ideas, I think that we pose a threat to the status quo because we are able to get our message out to people. But, I mean, it's very unfortunate. It's actually shocking when you have grown men, white men, talking about how we need more diversity and, diversity, it's a buzzword, how they just love it. America's great because of our diversity. Diversity is the best thing ever. We're strong because of our diversity. Like, what the hell does that even mean? On what basis do you make such a claim? I mean, it's really something else. I mean, it is a sick ideology, liberalism. And, unfortunately, so many people are programmed to think that way. But,
slowly changing. Exactly. And I mean, it has become a mantra. It has become a mind control, to a certain extent, kind of, enforcement. If you listen to those, how it's repeated with diversity is our strength. It's almost like, they know what they're doing. They're very, coercive in their propaganda, and they know how to kind of appeal to young people and stuff like that. But again, I'm from a European perspective, it's of course shocking to kind of realize that communism, which of course has had its haven in on the European continent and even in Asia recently and stuff like that, it's strange that it has gotten such a strong foothold in America. What I've found is you have to go back to the administration like FDR even to see the beginnings of it with people like, Harry Dexter White and even, Keynes, but there's other people around FDR at the time, which, his administration was riddled with communists at that time. Is that
right.
The beginnings of it?
With the communists and the communists of yesteryear, I think that they focused more on economic policy than the racial and cultural stuff that they do today.
Right.
I mean, if you look at Jack London, the famous American author, early 1900s, he was an open communist. But, I mean, if you read his works, there, you didn't get all of this white hatred in there. There's this hatred of patriotism and whatnot. I think it's relatively a recent phenomenon, probably starting with Franz Boas, the anthropologist, and the cultural relativism, moral relativism promoted by these people, these people who denied the reality of race. And I think that started in the 1960s, and we're at where we are today because of that.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. Boas and a number of other people, they initiated the step in that direction to take it into the cultural level, because economically they have joined with the capitalists kind of some time ago. We don't have to get too detailed into this, but, they have this idea of third way politics that they realized they couldn't defeat capitalism, so they joined it. People like Tony Blair and Bill Clinton was very successful in kind of merging these two. And then, so the issue was not who was going to win economically. They were joined already economically. So after that point is where the kind of the cultural war really began. And at that point, right. Of course, up to this point, they have been immensely successful, but that's changing. How are things today, would you say, at MSU and places like this? Is it worse than ever, or is there some opposition now to this?
Michigan State University and University of Michigan are worse than ever today. There's a group of alt-right guys in Michigan. We meet up every now and then to go to Mike Gruberies, and some of the guys will go out and will hang up alt-right posters on university campuses. I've not done that, but they do. And, they'll wear they used to wear the Make America Great Again Trump hats when they went out to do this on university campuses. And in Ann Arbor, which is a very left-wing city, they would get people glaring at them. A few people might, yell at them. There was no physical altercations. When these activists have gone to Michigan State University, East Lansing, to distribute literature, they can't go 25 yards on the sidewalk without somebody trying to physically assault them over it. It's the leftists are really riled up in East Lansing, and I don't know why that's the case. What's going on there as opposed to Ann Arbor, but it is a very left-wing culture that these universities promote.
Indeed. How successful do you think we're going to be with getting organizations like Antifa seen as a terrorist organization? I know that this was kind of an issue a while back. There was a petition to kind of for the government, I think for the federal government, to investigate them or to put them on a terror watch list, pretty much. What do you know about that? And is that an angle we can take, considering the fact that if we look at the definition of terrorism, that's basically going after people with violence and coercion due to their political beliefs. I think that pretty much is the textbook definition of terrorism. So that could potentially be a line argued, right?
Right. It's possible. Ultimately, I don't think that the government is interested in prosecuting left-wing terrorists because an enemy of an enemy is a friend, and as far as the U.S. government's concerned, the alt-right is the threat to their power over our people. And this is evidenced by the fact of how when violence does occur, there is a horrific double standard. I mean, you look at Chris Cantwell, he was practically a political prisoner. He maced somebody with pepper spray who attacked him. And they didn't even give him bond. They just held him in custody. And, you compare that with, what's his name, DeAndre Harris. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he was just caught high on marijuana with an AR-15 in his truck. And, he gets bonds, but not Cantwell. You look at, with the Michigan State events yesteryear, 10 years ago, the leftists were charged, some of them were charged with felonies for attacking police officers and resisting arrest and causing, significant problems. And the judge basically just gave them a slap on the wrist and did nothing about it. Many times the police departments aren't even interested in prosecuting people on the left side of the political spectrum for what they do. There was an occurrence at, Illinois, it was the Ashford House in Tinley Park. I don't know if you're familiar with this incident, are you?
No, tell us more about that.
You can actually find it on my website. If you go to kylebristow.com, and one of the tabs at the top under areas of practice, there's one called FOIA requests or records requests. Okay, you click it, and then when you go to that web page, there is a video I have published, which shows the records that I obtained. And pretty much the gist of it is that, half a decade ago or so, the nationalists were peacefully and privately meeting at a restaurant, and 20 or so masked and very armed Antifa thugs rushed into the restaurant and basically tried to beat them to death, hitting them with crowbars and baseball bats and knives and hammers. And the police took it very seriously because people who aren't involved in politics were present and they were injured too. And to my understanding, a prosecutor's daughter or somebody suffered a skull fracture because of the leftists attacking her at this venue. And so, to my understanding, the prosecutors really went after the leftists, and a number of them got prison time. But with regards to that situation, just to show you how the government, that's the video right there if you want to play it. If the, through the FOIA request I did, that it took me a while to get, we received video footage, never seen before, of leftists not wearing their masks. They had a rendezvous at like a Five Guys burger place before the event. And through the assistance of internet sleuths, we were actually able to identify some of these previously unknown culprits who engaged in this horrific attack. And I provided all of that information to the police, and they did absolutely nothing with it. Here's the leftists coming in. See, they're holding baseball bats and hammers.
Yeah,
look at them. They just absolutely trashed the place. I mean, there was blood everywhere. And if you listen to the audio of it, we had like 90 minutes of 911 calls and police dispatch communications. This is my favorite part. Watch this. Watch him. He's gonna grab this guy, grab him, tear over the head, throw him down. That's the best part. I love it.
There you go. Got to fight back against these creatures. Yeah, I mean, but this is amazing. It was old, very old people there too, you know, and they don't have any problems with any of this kind of stuff because they believe that they're doing the right thing. I mean, they believe that they're stopping violence by doing this kind of violence. That's basically what it boils down to.
Well, even the National Lawyer Guild, the radically left wing legal group, they provided legal representation to these leftists who attacked people who were otherwise just having lunch and exercising their right to free speech to associate with one another and to talk about politics. And the National Lawyer Guild lawyers argued in court that these leftists were acting in self-defense, that they had the moral high ground because they were attacking vile, evil Nazis.
Right.
But for leftists attacking peaceful, law-abiding citizens who are expressing their political views, we would have another Holocaust.
That's exactly.
Really how they process this nonsense. So, watch the guy with the chair. Boom.
Yeah.
When Nathan D'Amico punched Moldylocks, remember that incident?
Oh, yeah, of course.
I watched that video probably 2,000 times, and I giggle like a little girl every time I watch it. I mean, she deserved what she got.
She held bottles and stuff, and there was other footage of her was released with, yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is what they do, right? I mean, is there any... So the charges made against people who think differently than these people who are very violent and stuff like that is as you say, it's because they're Nazis, they want to kill people, it's going to, you know, lead to all these violence acts or whatever. That's something which I wish could be, maybe even in a court of law, like be defined or something, like that they call us Nazis and stuff like that, and we know that that's not actually, you know, accurate.
Correct.
I'm not saying that there isn't some who call themselves alt-right that would be maybe calling themselves also National Socialists, but I'm saying when they talk about Nazism, they talk about this kind of cartoonish version of it, if you will, of like Darth Vader and like evil that has manifested itself in the world. But is there anything that can be, argued legally from that point of view?
What we need to do, we need to stop relying on government prosecutors to enforce the criminal law. We need to stop relying on third-party advocacy groups like the American Civil Liberties Union to defend our First Amendment rights. We need to stand up for ourselves through our own legal institution and our own media outlets. And that's what I've done through the Foundation for the Marketplace of Ideas. Your listeners can visit our website at freedomfront.org. New York Times interviewed me not too long ago about the creation of this group, and The Atlantic said that because the ACLU is now acting with much more reservation when it comes to defending free speech rights of the alt-right, that this group is going to fill that void, and that unlike the ACLU, this group is going to promote an agenda that is otherwise not in line with the ACLU. And, I mean, we need to create our own institutions. We need to sue leftists. I mean, when a leftist attacks an alt-right activist, that leftist should be sued. We should get a judgment against them. And we should garnish their wages into perpetuity.
Of course.
I mean, we should accept their tax refunds. We should, garnish their bank accounts and garnish their wages. I mean, that's what needs to happen. We need to stand up for ourselves. And it can be done. It can be done. Back when I was in law school, I did document drafting and legal research for a lawyer who was representing David Yeagley. David Yeagley has since passed away, but if you Google him, he was an American Indian activist. However, he was on the right side of the political spectrum, and he even spoke at American Renaissance conferences. And because the leftists got the American Renaissance Conference shut down that he was supposed to speak at, he stood up for his rights. He filed a lawsuit against Daryl Lamont Jenkins, the leftist who runs One People's Project. And we ended up getting a $50,000 judgment against Daryl Lamont Jenkins. And unfortunately, no collection efforts occurred as far as I know because Yeagley passed away. And his estate wasn't comfortable with assigning the judgment to a debt collector for collection purposes. But, it is very possible and doable to win cases, either through a judgment or by settling the matter. I think a lot of judges are because we are law-abiding, and because the law is on our side, even though the judges may not like our political ideas, it is easy for them to side in our favor. Now is the time to take a stand and to, legally speaking, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, exactly. We have to fight back and just not let these things go. I'm surprised that there hasn't been more by these people who have been fired, for example, that they've gone after their employee. I know that, some employment contracts are different and they can fire people for no reason or whatever, but it's clear that this has been over their political views. And I'm also surprised, Kyle, that more of the so-called free speech groups and activists and stuff like that have not come out in support of many of these people. They would probably do so at the detriment of their own reputation, I would gather, and that's why they're staying away.
Lawyers are, by and large, very cowardly people. Lawyers are disgusting. I mean, I'm a lawyer, but I'm not that way. I know that a lot of the criminal defendants, the alt-right guys in Charlottesville, they struggled to find criminal defense lawyers to represent them. They could not pay criminal defense attorneys to represent them any sum of money. Criminal defense attorneys said, no, we want nothing to do with this case. That was very telling. You also had the Andrew Anglin case up in Montana. It was a struggle finding local counsel to team up with Mark Randazza to, provide legal assistance about that for that case. I mean, with these left-wing lawyers and the normie lawyers or whatever you want to call them, they are afraid of controversy.
Yeah, I know. And it's I feel that it's also over the reason that they don't know where the people that they would potentially defend stand politically. They've just been swept away by the incredibly hostile media, and they think and they assume and all these things. If most people were giving us the time and actually sat down and spoke with us and said, what do you want politically? What you know, how do you see things playing out, et cetera? Just asking and inquiring about our opinions and our ideologies and where we want to see things politically. They would see that we're reasonable people. They would see that we're not hateful people. They see we're not evil people. But that kind of that issue has not occurred yet. There's a disconnection between what the media is presenting and who we really are. You know,
we are ultimately the true conservatives of yesteryear. And I don't use the word conservative anymore to define myself because it has such a limp-wristed connotation these days.
Sure.
But I mean, if you go back into the early 1900s, the traditional minded conservatives were pro-white. They were economic nationalists. They were patriotic. They were morality inclined, where they were opposed to sexual degeneracy and all that nonsense. We are the real right wing of the country.
You could say, I think, Kyle, that, you know, and I've said this many times before, but the political spectrum has moved so much, but those people that have stood firm in their beliefs have been kind of, as the spectrum moves, they have moved on the spectrum, if you see what I'm saying. So they're now seen
right.
as some kind of crazy right-winger or something, when they, in fact, are, as you say, just they have traditional values, and I think Woz mentioned this once, which was a really good way of framing it, and he said, basically, you know, many of us just want what our grandparents took for granted. And that's I know that there's some people that go further than that, but I'm just saying overall, that's like a very sensible position, and there's many that think that way. And it's not actually extremism.
Right, that's very true. That's a good point.
So what other cases are you working on right now? And before we kind of talk a bit more about the website and how people can support you guys, and are you wishing to bring on more people to the team? Do you see this expanding? How do you see this
going? Right. Basically, with the Foundation for the Marketplace of Ideas, we are developing a legal network. Lawyers throughout the country have contacted me to join our network attorney referral list. And so when people contact the organization in need of legal assistance, I can send them on to one of the attorneys in their own states. And, attorneys don't necessarily have to practice the area of law for which they're providing assistance to the prospective client because, for example, if it's a First Amendment issue, I can assist a lawyer in a different state with document drafting and legal research. And so we are able to, have an extensive reach to, so as to be able to help people. Right now we are working on fundraising. We are working on, developing our legal network. We are aggressively helping, connect people with lawyers who need, legal assistance. And so the, organization is really taking off. And back in 2016, in the summer, we had an alt-right conference in Detroit. It was a weekend long, and it was incredible. We had a private venue, catered food, an open bar. Richard Spencer spoke. Nathan D'Amico spoke. We just had an amazing time at the place we were at. We had about 70 or 80 people in attendance, and everybody was completely vetted, so it was a very private function. During the weekend-long conference, we went to a number of excellent restaurants. We did a tour of Detroit. We visited various ruins that were iconic. I called it a safari of Detroit. So.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's a dilapidated city. That's just the reality of it.
Right, right. And it was, we visited the Detroit Art Museum. And the Detroit Art Museum is interesting because Detroit, in its heyday, was considered the Paris of the West.
That's right.
Detroit was an incredibly affluent city back in the day. And back when it had all of this massive wealth, it acquired the art in its art museum. And it's actually one of the best art museums in the world, believe it or not. And, so we were able to visit it and, check things out. But yeah, so I mean, between the private conferences, assisted with hosting Things Edwards said, he stood with bringing Dr. James Sanchez in to talk. So, FMI is doing quite a bit.
Yes, indeed. Let's talk about how people can support you guys, too. I want to see your organization grow. I want to have that as, it's super important. I mean, let's think about it, to be able to fight back, to know so that these other, whether that it's employees or whatever it is that are discriminating on people's political beliefs, know that they're not safe. That's usually what it's about. It's about so that they know that they just can't do these things indiscriminately, right? So this is a way to fight back. This is a way that people can actually have an organization to both go to and have people, represented by someone who will take their case. So I think this is a super important, group. So thank you. Were you responsible for creating it and set it up in the beginning, Kyle?
Yes. I created everything. I founded it, and I serve as its executive director with a number of board members who assist me with its operations. For your viewers, people can donate if they would like to assist us by going to freedomfront.org/donate. People can mail us cash. They can send to us checks or money orders. They can donate by GuideStar. If you donate via GuideStar or by cash or check or money order, you get a tax deductible donation receipt in return, so it's a tax write-off, and then people can also support us through supporting me at Patreon or donating cryptocurrency.
Exactly, very good. Yeah, it's definitely some Dash, some Litecoin. That way it's nice and private as well, obviously.
Right.
So those are, and but of course you do accept Bitcoin and Ethereum as well on top of that, so that's great. Yeah, though, just short on that, by the way, how do you see cryptocurrencies as a way around much of the bank discrimination that we've seen, people shutting down accounts or things like this?
Right. It's very dangerous in this era trying to operate an organization insofar as the floor can be ripped out right from under you. You can lose your website provider. You can lose access to use various banks, credit card processors. That's what's going on with Hadrian right now. The credit card companies are refusing to do business with it. We definitely need to create our own institution so as to operate. And, other than creating media outlets such as your group or legal entities like FMI, we definitely need to adapt to these crazy times and, using cryptocurrency does work. I mean, if you look at Weave from the Daily Stormer, I think he has brought in over $2 million in cryptocurrency. So good for him. And I think the Daily Stormer itself brought in like $500,000 or something. There's this Twitter bot that keeps track of who's donating to who. And there's serious money with cryptocurrency.
And by the way, people can just set up a new wallet if they, if this guy who's tracking all these transactions, all you need is a new wallet address and he won't be able to keep track of it anymore. If people are concerned with privacy, you can literally create a My Ether wallet, a new one every time you're, asking for a donation.
Every time you want to do a donation.
Yeah.
Right. Well, with the cryptocurrency tracker, all it knows is how much money these organizations or people are receiving. They don't know the source of the money.
Exactly.
As far as my understanding of it is.
Yeah.
And so there's still incredible privacy, through people who donate cryptocurrency. And it definitely is a preferred route.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. I think it's a really good option. Obviously, it's very volatile. It's very dangerous. People got to be careful, especially if they do invest and keep some of the money in there. But it's just, that's the nature of new things when they come aboard, Next thing, alt-right blockchain. That's the next thing. No, but it's a very interesting technology, and frankly, I think it's an excellent way for us and many other groups as well to bypass all these in between organizations and like banks that basically sit on top and say, you know, basically approve a transaction between you and another party and saying, yeah, okay, I'll approve this. But next time they say, no, we might not approve this. And then, you're stranded. And with this peer-to-peer kind of way of doing things, you can do it directly. And, of course, if people can both buy in and also then cash out in fiat currency, such as U.S. dollars or euros from these cryptos, so it's not locked there, obviously. But anyway, that's a different show in itself, Kyle. But it's interesting that these new things are showing up that we can use at our disposal, bypassing governments that are censoring and bypassing media and all these kinds of things. So I'm very excited about it. But
I was shocked how easy it is to use, too. With the various ways to convert it into real cash where it's sent to your bank account. It's still somewhat magical to me. I don't quite understand it, but I do know that when people donate, I can get money into the bank account for FMI through it. So
yeah, exactly. Cool. Guys, I'll add a link, of course, to freedomfront.org, and you can just go there and /donate. I'll add it down in the description, so check that out if you want to help out. And then also, of course, to kylebristow.com. That's the main website where you can take a look at some of his own personal cases and stuff like that. Thank you so much for coming on, Kyle. Really appreciate it. Keep us abreast on terms of what's going on. We'd love to have you back again in the future. If there's any specific cases you're fighting, come back again, and we'll talk about it, okay?
I thank you very much for having me, and I hope to see you at Michigan State when Richard Spencer has his speech.
We'll try to make it, for sure. Thank you, Kyle.
Excellent. Very good. Take care.
You too. Bye. All right, folks, there you go. Thank you for joining us today here for this show with Kyle Bristow. Much more coming up, of course. We have Alfred Schaefer coming on the show soon. He's a guest who's been with us before. Actually, his sister, due to some of the YouTube videos that she has done, has ended up in trouble in Germany. The latest thing I heard from Alfred was that the authorities have visited him and I believe her place again as well, 10 people that confiscated, I believe, computers and things like this. This has been a case that's been ongoing for some time, but very little media attention on it. So I'm looking forward to speaking more with Alfred about this and why they've ended up in this situation. Very important case. After that, we have John Ott coming on the show. He's also a previous guest. We spoke with him about the Oera Linda book, a mythological work on the Frisians, kind of a really ancient story, really, about the people living in that region of the Netherlands and Holland. But they also had a kind of a chronological detailing, if you will, of other tribal groups going back thousands of years in Western Europe. Very interesting book. I believe that he's looking into publishing that, possibly with Countercurrents. They're doing a new translation of that book now as well. So we're going to bring him back on the show to talk more about that, something a little bit different for you. We're also looking forward to getting Paul Nealon on the show. I hope we can book him in. We've been talking with him, so we're trying to find a date that's fitting. But beyond that, of course, we have much more coming, guys. Weekend Warrior that we do on redicemembers.com or for members, exclusive. If you want to check that out, the weekend show that Lana and I host, definitely get a membership with us. Get a subscription. That's the best way. If you're watching this through YouTube, definitely make sure that you subscribe. If you're new to the show, we have much more coming. We're also doing exclusive videos at redicemembers.com, not only the weekend show, but we're doing other solo videos and stuff like that. The last thing we did was a review of the show Smilf, actually. Very degenerate but hilarious stuff to make fun of. So definitely check that out in the members section. All right, that's it for this time, guys. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back in just a few days. Stay tuned. We'll see you soon.